Now, in this session, we're going to consider perhaps the most important of the classical arguments for the existence of God, the so-called cosmological argument. Now, keep in mind, before we examine that particular argument, at least in one of its more basic formulations, that historically the three arguments that are generally considered to be the most frequently established arguments for the existence of God are known as the ontological argument, the teleological argument, and the one we're going to examine today, the cosmological argument. How many of you have never heard of the ontological argument? That means you all have heard of the ontological argument. And since you heard it and you're so familiar with it, maybe I'll get somebody here to state it succinctly for the benefit of everyone. What is the ontological argument? Who can tell me? And who is famous, most famous for its formulation? Well, we've all heard of such an argument, but nobody has any idea what it is or... Don't laugh out there on television. This could be you on the spot here in the room. The ontological argument is usually associated with St. Anselm, who gave it its most sophisticated form. Although we find various kinds of ontological arguments for the existence of God throughout church history, we find one, for example, in St. Augustine. We find the most famous one in St. Anselm. Then we find a refinement of that in Descartes, and then later by a rational philosopher by the name of Christian Wolff. And basically, the ontological argument is an attempt to argue for the existence of God strictly on a formal basis, moving from the concept of God in one's mind to the reality of God in existence. And St. Anselm's formula is very tricky and has been the occasion of many of an Excedrin headache for the student who tries to understand it, who tries to defend it, and even for those who try to critique it. I have the idea of the most perfect being conceivable in my mind, and that which is the most perfect being conceivable must exist in reality as well as my mind, because if he doesn't exist in reality, he's not the most perfectly conceivable being, because that which is existing in reality is more perfect than that which is existing merely as a mental concept, and on it goes, and we get into a lot of fun with the ontological argument. But it moves from thought to being, from conception to reality. And I'll just say that and move on, because we could spend a lot of time on it, and it's important in the history of the church. But more familiar, I think, and more frequently is heard, the teleological argument, so named because it comes from the concept of teleology, which is a subdivision of philosophy. And teleology, in turn, comes from the Greek word telos, which means end, purpose, or goal. So that the teleological argument is an argument that proceeds from the appearance of order and harmony and purpose that is found in the universe. When we see that the universe functions according to certain regular patterns of behavior and apparently some degree of fixed laws, when we see some kind of purpose found, for example, in the ways in which the bees pollinate flowers and the rest, all of this thing sort of helps out in the balance and cycle of nature, it screams for the question, who put it all together? It seems like you can't have purpose accidentally. You can't have intelligence without some kind of an intelligent cause. That's the argument. And even a man like Kant says, of all of the arguments for the existence of God, the one that he found most impressive was the teleological argument, the argument simply from design. Namely, that there appears to be some rhyme or reason, there appears to be some design to the universe, and design presupposes what? A designer. And so this is the argument that God is the architect or designer of the universe. But the one I want to spend time on today is the one I think that most people are familiar with to a certain degree, and that is the cosmological argument, so-called cosmological, because it takes its cue from the word cosmos, which means the world or the universe. And the cosmological argument is tied historically to natural theology because it involves an argument for the existence of a transcendent God from the existence of this world. It involves reasoning from the cosmos to God as the author or first cause of the world. Now, the cosmological argument has taken many different shapes and forms and different and has been advanced in different levels of sophistication in church history, and it's been the subject of very, very rigorous scrutiny and critique from those who have found it lacking. And what I want to do now is to go over the cosmological argument in what I believe to be its most simple and most elementary form. In fact, I think that the more simply the argument is stated, the more powerful it tends to be. Now, the argument begins with certain assumptions, and that is, the first assumption is that something is. Or to state it another way, something exists now. And what the conclusion is trying to reach is that since something exists now, something exists necessarily or eternally. To state it another way, if something exists now, then something has always existed. If something exists now, then something has always existed. And that something which has always existed has the power of being within itself, or hence it has necessary being. Now that's what the argument tries to demonstrate. Now let's see if it can do it and how it proceeds. If we start with the opening assumption that there is something that exists, or at least something seems to exist right now. I am sitting here talking about reality, and I apparently exist, and you are listening to me, and perhaps you exist as well. Now, in searching for a sufficient cause for that, a rational scientific explanation for the fact that something exists, we can seek different options to explain that present reality. And that's the way we're going to proceed. Something appears to exist. And what are the possibilities? I'm going to list a few and then ask you to add some to them. The first is that that which seems to exist is an illusion. And there is no such existence at all. So that really nothing exists. Everything that seems to exist is merely an illusion. That's one possibility that we'll consider. Second is that something does exist, and that which exists is self-existent. And eternal. Next possibility is that that which exists is self-created. next possibility is that that which exists is created ultimately by that which is self-existent. Okay. Now, can you add some other possibilities to that? That which is, exists now, is eternal, self-existent. That which exists now is self-created, or that which exists now is created by something other than itself, which is self-existent, ultimately. Any other alternatives? We could add that that which exists now is created by something else that was created by something else that was created by something else. But ultimately, we're going to have to answer the question whether that which started the creation of finite beings was itself either self-created, self-existent, or created by something before it, which was self-existent. Any other possibilities? Now, there may be, just because we are unable to add some here. I haven't really seen anybody be able to add to this list without just restating one of these in another form. Most people are satisfied that these are the options. Now let's look at them and see if there are any of those four that we can eliminate either rationally or scientifically. The first is that that which exists is an illusion. What would you say to that? Yes.
Even if it is an illusion, something still
exists. Even if it's an illusion, we have to ask the question, is the illusion eternal? Is the illusion self-existent? Is the illusion self-created? Or is the illusion created by something that is self-existent? Because the presupposition here, or the assumption is that if it all is an illusion, for it to be an illusion, it has to be illusory to someone. This raises the ancient question of solipsism, the idea that perhaps I am the only real existing being and everything else in the world is a projection of my consciousness or a projection of my imagination, or is taking place in my dream life, that you're just part of my dream. But still we have to account for the dreamer, or the one who is being deluded. But for the most part, in terms of the practical efficiency of this argument, most people are willing to grant that something exists now. And so we'll cut the Gordian knot there and say, let's beg the question if we have to. Let's start with our working assumption that something exists. And if something exists, how do we account for it? Now, you may not be able to get everybody to agree that something exists. And you're going to have to argue about whether they're an illusion and you're an illusion. From a Christian perspective, if somebody is insisting that everything is an illusion, then we don't really have to take their argument seriously because they've eliminated themselves from any real status, because we can consider their arguments as part of that all-encompassing illusion. And not only their arguments, that they themselves are vaporous illusion and need not be taken seriously. But let's eliminate that and go to the real issues, and that is, if something exists now, granted that something exists now, then that which exists is either self-existent, self-created, or created by something that is self-existent. Now let me jump ahead of ourselves and look at this concept of self-creation first. The notion of self-creation has a built-in formal problem to it. What is it? For something to create itself, It would have to be before it is. It would have to exist and not exist at the same time and in the same relationship. So that the idea of self-creation is formally absurd and irrational. Again, for something to create itself, it would have to be an agent of its own creation, before it is. So it would have to be and not be at the same time and in the same relationship. So that the idea, intellectually and formally, violates, number one, it violates the law of contradiction. What other law does it violate? The law of causality. Because if it was not and then is, then it qualifies for the definition of an effect. It is contingent, it is derived, it is dependent, it is not eternal, it is not self-existent. So by definition, it is an effect. And if it is an effect that comes from nothing, then you would have an effect without a cause, which violates the law of causality. So that self-creation violates two of those principles that we've already examined very carefully. Now, self-creation, if I state it in these words, is manifestly absurd and contradictory. But the objection may arise, but that's not a fair formulation of alternatives that have been made. For example, we've seen the alternatives put forward that the universe came by spontaneous generation or that the universe has been created by chance. Now remember when we mentioned the Enlightenment thinkers, the age of the Enlightenment, one of the fundamental assertions of the skepticism that came out of the Enlightenment was that the God hypothesis is no longer a necessary hypothesis to explain man and his world. And the French encyclopedias, particularly de Holbach and Diderot, argued strongly that we have a perfectly adequate scientific explanation for the world apart from appealing to a divine creation, and that adequate explanation is the idea of spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation meaning that there was nothing, and then poof, like magic, the world came into being on its own. Now, they didn't call that self-creation. They called it spontaneous generation. But I'm not able to see any significant difference between the concept of spontaneous generation and the concept of self-creation. Both violate the principle that we mentioned the other day, ex nihilo, nihil fit. Ex nihilo, nihil fit. Out of nothing, nothing comes. Because nothing has no being, and that which has no being has no power, and so there can be no power in nothingness to bring something into being. And if there is nothing, then there is absolutely no efficient cause, let alone a sufficient cause, for the world to come into being. Spontaneous generation means that you have an effect that has no efficient cause, no sufficient cause, no instrumental cause, no formal cause, no final cause. No cause whatsoever. Now, again, for the most part, modern scientists, not all, but most, have abandoned the idea of spontaneous generation. But still, you won't have people coming along and say, I believe the universe created itself. Instead, they'll use language, as I mentioned the other day in our discussion, that I heard from a professor who was a professor at Harvard and was involved in a postdoctoral 2-year program in the history of science and philosophy, who argued that the universe was created ultimately by chance. I was astonished to hear that by such an educated, erudite, perceptive man, but to say that ultimately the universe is created by chance. Now, I want to examine that by way of language and show that to say that the universe came into being by chance is no different from saying, substantially, that the universe was created by nothing. The reason I say that is this. Let me ask you the question Socratically. What is the ontological status of chance? We need today an ontology of chance. Ontology has to do with the science of what? Being. Okay, so what is the being of chance? How much being does chance have? Absolutely none. How much power does chance have to influence anything? We say we're going to flip a coin, and I say, what are the chances that if I flip this coin, it's going to come up heads? What are the chances, Lucy Lee? What are the odds? 50-50, right? Yeah. How about if I flip it 9 times and 9 times in a row it comes up head? And now I pick it up again. What are the odds it's going to come up heads this time?
Same thing.
50-50, okay? Because it only has two possibilities, heads or tails, unless it sticks in a crack and stands on end. Now, do you see how easy it is when we recognize that we can project possibilities and reduce possibilities by statistical analysis and probability quotient and set up the odds and find that it's amazing how frequently things do correspond to the odds. But it's easy to jump from that and assume that chance, this concept, is doing something to influence and affect the outcome of the action. Now, if I flip a coin, what does chance have to do with producing or causing the final result of whether or not that coin comes up heads or tails? Absolutely nothing. How that coin ends up is determined in the first instance by whether I started on my thumb heads up or tails up, how much pressure I exert with my thumb, how dense the atmosphere is, how many times it turns over in the air, where it is when I catch it at the bottom. Those are the things that determine whether it comes up heads or tails, not chance. The word chance is simply a word that we use to describe mathematical possibilities. But chance is no being. It is no thing. It has no power. And so, really, we can say that since chance has no being and no power, it is no thing. Or, if you will, nothing. And so when this sophisticated professor told me that the universe was created by chance, and we put that under the microscope and examined it, he was really saying that the universe was created by nothing, which really means that the universe, if it were indeed created, if it once was not and now is, then in fact it was self-created. I have to just tell you that in this particular case, it had a happy ending. This particular professor saw that suddenly, and he was embarrassed. He said, gee, I didn't realize, what I was doing. Really, what he had to take his tack. Really, what he was really arguing was that there was an eternal mass of matter. That 8 to 10 million years ago, changed its course. The big explosion. We got back into the Big Bang thing. Or call that mass a mass of energy. But it was a mass of something that had ontological status and power that for some inexplicable reason, 8 to 10 billion years ago, suddenly changed its behavioral pattern. And he said, I don't know why it did. I can only say there were certain chances that it would move in this way rather than the other. And so what he was really saying is that the change was a chance thing in the sense is that I don't know why it changed. I don't know why the motion suddenly came. I mean, you start thinking about this. If you think of a mass of matter that is eternally inert, and then, all of a sudden, it explodes. You have as big a problem to explain that intellectually as you do the idea of self-creation. Now, if you say it's eternally in motion, was it eternally in motion in what direction? If it's eternally and self-existently in motion, is it in the same pattern, or is there some, if it's in the same pattern, then we have a locked eternal situation that cannot possibly change. If it's not, that is, if it's changing, then you're faced with finitude, you're faced with that which is mutable, that which is contingent, that which is derived, and you're still left with all of these questions that we're left with now at looking at the universe. And to just push back the problem 8 to 10 billion years does not solve the problem of the alternatives that I've set before you. But in any case, people try to slip around it by saying that the universe came into being by chance or spontaneous generation. Both chance, spontaneous generation, compromise the law of contradiction and the law of causality. And it's amazing to me that the most frequent argument against the cosmological argument that we encounter in the history of philosophy is some form, some type of argument that argues for the self-creation of the universe. Study it carefully. Look at the philosophical argument, and you will see somewhere along the way the negotiation of the law of contradiction or the law of causality. All right, so we can eliminate this as being formally falsifiable, because this concept is formally invalid, it is absurd and irrational. So that leaves us only two possibilities. I wanted to go back here further. We now have two possibilities. Either the universe itself is self-existent and eternal, or it is created by something that is self-existent and eternal. Now, if either one of these happens to be the answer, have we already established our initial assertion? Remember, the initial assertion, the modicum of a force that we were trying to argue for was that if something exists now, something has always existed. If something exists now, something exists necessarily. The only alternative to that is some idea of self-creation, which we've just shown is absurd. So that reason itself can argue that if something exists now, something has always existed, and can argue that irrefutably. But we're still not home free with the Christian God by any means, are we? All that we've shown is that something exists eternally. There always had to be something. You can't argue for once there was absolutely nothing and then nothing produced something. Now, the issue, though, is that universe self-existent and eternal, or is there something beyond the universe that transcends the universe that is self-existent and eternal from which the universe comes? Now, here is where the argument moves out of the rational sphere into the empirical sphere. Because when we look, well, before we make that move, let's just take a second to examine the notion of self-existence. Is it logically
conceptually and formally possible for something to exist in and of itself eternally? Does that notion violate the law of contradiction? Does the concept of self-existence, that something has the power to be in and of itself, violate any law of logic? No. It may be very mysterious. It may be unlike anything we're accustomed to in this world, because everything that we see seems to be dependent on other things and seems to undergo changes and through the process of generation and decay and all of those things that we normally associate with finitude. But intellectually, to conceive of something self-existent and eternal violates no law of logic. Does it violate any law of causality? For something to be its own cause, if an effect is its own cause, then we have a violation of causality. But for something to be uncaused does not violate the law of causality. For an effect to be uncaused violates the law of causality, because the law of causality says that every effect must have an antecedent cause. And that's true for all effects. But what about the idea of something that has no antecedent, that's eternal, has the power of being in itself? It's not an effect by definition. So it requires no antecedent cause, because it always is, it always was, it exists in and of itself. So that has no problems formally with self-existence. Now, here is where a very subtle argument comes in. Somebody say, well, just because self-existence has no formal problems with it, does that mean that there is something self-existent? See, Kant would jump in and say, just because self-existent passes the test of logic, does that mean that actually there is something out there that corresponds to self-existent reality? No. Again, just because we can conceive of something being self-existent and therefore does not violate the law of logic, does not mean that there is such a thing. And we're not arguing that there is such a thing simply on the basis of its conceptual possibility. We're arguing on the basis of the fact that there is something now. And if there is something now, then there must be something self-existent. So that the argument at that point involves the initial assertion that something is. So we're arguing from reality to transcendent reality, not from concept to reality. We're arguing from nature to supernature. Now, what's left to decide is whether or not what we perceive in this world is that which is self-existent and eternal, or whether or not there's something beyond this world that is self-existent and eternal. Let me say it again. What we're left with are two alternatives. Either that which we perceive is self-existent and eternal, or there is something above and beyond metaphysically that which we perceive that is self-existent and eternal. But something must be self-existent and eternal. Now the argument turns to an examination of things in this world and see whether or not they manifest self-existence or whether they manifest contingency. I look at this Rigo root beer, you know, and I see this bottle, and I see that this bottle is capable of being reshaped and restructured and changed. It can be broken. It can be thrown in a garbage can. It can be recycled, all of that. Marx, all these changes indicate what we call ontological modes of contingency. So they do not qualify. But you can argue, but wait a minute. Wait a minute. Really, matter, in its substance, in its essence, is eternal. It may go through accidental changes on the outside as we perceive them. But it is the world that is eternal and self-existent. It is matter that is eternal, or energy as some form of matter, that is eternal and transcendent. The argument comes here that we do not have to go outside of the universe, above the universe, beyond the universe, to find self-existence. We find it right here in the material universe. And there are materialists who argue for the eternality of matter. David Hume, for example, raises this objection to the cosmological argument. He says that we look around, and he would grant, as most people do, that we're surrounded by evidence of contingency. Okay? Right? We're surrounded by evidence of contingency, of things in a state of becoming, in a state of potentiality, rather than in a state of pure essence that doesn't change. Everywhere we go, we see change, as Heraclitus indicated. But Hume's objection is this: why do we have to assume that we have to go beyond the universe to a transcendent God to explain the principle of transcendence and self-existence? How do we know that there's not a part of this universe as yet unknown or as yet unexplored which has the eternal power of self-existence within it that generates in one way or another, modalistically or through process, as we find in the panentheists, that this, whatever it is within the universe, and that which is within the universe is that which is giving the power of being to the rest of the universe. We have not explored every nook and cranny of the universe. Maybe there is that little corner of the globe or that little corner of the universe that is self-existent. We don't have to go up above it to find God. Now I'm going to ask you, how would you respond to that? This is the second most frequent objection given to the cosmological argument, that it is the universe itself, at least in some small part or undetected dimension of it, in which we find the ultimate power for the source of all things, the self-existent necessary power. But we don't need to be transcendent in our thinking. The power for being is immanent to the world. It is built into the structure of things eternally. How would you answer that? Does anybody have any idea? Or is it this the fatal flaw of the cosmological argument? What falls to pieces? Yes? Well, that's a problem. It's theoretically verifiable if you can find it. But so far it hasn't been found. It's an unknown quantity. Well, let's look at this inner within the universe, immanent principle that is the cause for everything else. What would that have to be in the first instance? Self-existent, okay, and eternal. Let's just stop at that point. How does that part differ from everything else? Everything else is contingent and derived. Only this unknown blip within the universe has the ontological characteristic of self-existence. Now, this is precisely what transcendence is all about. When the philosopher speaks about transcendent being, it speaks not about a being that is located necessarily physically up there, in spatial categories removed from everything else. But transcendence is determined by ontology and the critical characteristic of ontological transcendence. Is self-existence. It's by the very virtue of something self-existent that it, in terms of its being, transcends everything else that is not self-existent. And so when the materialists want to say that there is some undiscovered something that is self-existent and eternal, that's precisely what we're arguing for, that there is something transcendent. It transcends it being-wise. He wants to locate it in the universe. You know, graphically, geographically, I don't care where you locate it, it is still differentiated from everything else that is not self-existent and eternal. And the whole argument, cosmologically, is to try to argue to the metaphysical level of transcendence, not to some spatial level of transcendence. And if he is saying that the universe is explained by some little blurb that we haven't found yet that is self-existent and eternal, he is saying that all the contingencies out here lead us to believe that there must be something that is not contingent, that is self-existent eternal, and he's just made the metaphysical move that Kant said you can't make. He's just moved from the contingent to the eternal. From the accidents to the essence. He's just penetrated the noumenal world. He just happens to want to locate it in his picture of it, in his drawing of it, in his graphic design of it, underneath this line rather than over the line. But he's already crossed that ontological line. Whether he crosses it down here or in here or up here or over there, he's crossed that line as soon as he talks about something being self-existent and eternal. So what I'm saying is, no matter how you slice it, if something exists now, something always exists. Because the eternal world theory is basically another way of saying creation by something that is self-existent. Unless you argue that every single object and particular item and data bit in the universe is itself eternal and self-existent. Then you have an empirical problem. Then we have to negotiate the basic reliability sense perception that screams to us that things do in fact change, at least at the accidental level, in their outward appearances. And if nothing else is not eternal, it would be the outward appearances. So there's something contingent, namely the outward appearances. And there has to be something behind that which is not contingent, namely the eternal self-existent essence. So something exists eternally and necessarily. Now the next question we have to define, I mean, maybe all we have proven so far is that something is self-existent and eternal. We haven't proved that there's only one thing, or that that thing is intelligent, or that that thing is holy, or that that thing is Yahweh. All we're trying to say is that there is some self-existent eternal being who must be there, or some self-eternal something that must be there to account for the presence of our existing universe. And that some concept of creation must follow once you accept a single bit of contingency in this world. Now, that so far has not taken us to the biblical God. And therefore, many critics of the cosmological argument say, why even fool with it? Because it doesn't take us to God. Let me tell you why we fool with it. Because the first assertion that the Bible makes about the biblical God is that he is creator. And that God is eternal. And that the world is not eternal. This is the fundamental assertion of Judeo-Christianity. That there is an eternal being whom we call God, who exists in and of himself and is responsible for the creation of this world. And it's particularly that point that the critics of Judeo-Christianity have attacked down through church history, saying that we don't need to believe in Christianity. In fact, we won't believe in Christianity because we don't believe in creation of any kind. We believe merely in, you know, ex nihilo, out of, you know, self-creation, or we believe in the eternal matter. All of those alternatives are used as a philosophical foundation to reject Judeo-Christianity. Now, if we can show that reason and science both demand an eternally self-existent necessary being who is responsible for creation, then what value does that have to Christianity? It has just cut out the foundation from the chief criticisms against the Christian doctrine of God, who argue against a self-existent eternal being. Now, we have to go beyond the cosmological argument to give content to that self-existent eternal creator. We have to go beyond the cosmological argument to get to personality and things like that within God. But keep this in mind, that which has been attacked, and remember, apologetics is the science of giving a reply to the critics, that which has been attacked again and again, and that which has been negotiated, is the very point of God's eternal self-existence. And if we can demonstrate through the argument that something must be eternally self-existent, we have kicked the props out from under the skepticism of Kant and the criticism of the vast majority of critics to the Christian life and worldview. And we've established our first critical point in the case for Christianity, namely the idea of an eternal self-existent creator. Now, one last little thread needs to be tied up. Remember, we said the other day that the law of causality repudiates the notion of ex nihilo, nihil fit. No, I mean, it repudiates the idea that ex nihilo something fit. The law is that out of nothing, nothing comes. Yet Christianity asserts creation ex nihilo. Doesn't the Christian, therefore, have to violate the law of causality in order to affirm his doctrine of creation, where he says that God creates the world out of nothing? God creates the world out of nothing, yes.
It has an efficient cause, but it doesn't have an efficient.
Exactly. When we say ex nihilo nihil fit, out of nothing, nothing comes, that means out of this nothing, there is no material cause, no matter out of which the universe comes. There is no efficient cause, no power to bring it about. There is no sufficient cause, no instrumental cause, as I mentioned. Christianity says that the universe is created ex nihilo, that is, there's no material cause out of which God shapes the world. But it does not say that there is no efficient cause. There is an efficient cause, and there's a sufficient cause, namely, the creative power of this self-existent eternal being. In the Christian view, you have, before the world exists, something existing, namely someone, the eternally self-existent God. It's one thing for me to say that a self-existent eternal being can create something out of no pre-established material. How he does it is a mystery. I mean, I haven't, cleared up the mystery of creation. I don't know how a self-existent eternal being can call matter out of nothing, but at least we have the power of his efficiency. It's not nothing calling something out of nothing. It is one with self-existent powers and the power of being within himself. And he has that power of being eternally. For him to communicate the power of existence to something else is what is involved in the act of creation. But we don't know how it's done or the mode of creation, but we know at least that formally there's an efficient cause and a sufficient cause, whereas alternatives to that have not only no material cause, but they have no efficient, no sufficient, no final, no formal, no instrumental cause whatsoever. So,
Let me say it again. In simplest form, something exists now, then something exists necessarily. And that argument, I think, is a very, very powerful and cogent argument and should be used in spite of Kant's denial to the contrary. Right, let me wrap this up now for now, and we'll go on with other dimensions of this in the next hour.